Dawn Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the free Odyssey app.
Valerie Klosterman has faithfully played piano at church for 30 years. Her family has a long history here in Caledonia, Michigan.
My grandma was an RN. She worked at the Metropolitan Hospital System for almost 40 years. My mom started when she was 16. She was an LPN. She also worked for the same hospital system. Yeah, for me, when I needed to look for a job, that's where I went. Of course, I would want to continue their legacy, be able to make them proud of me in more ways than one.
So Valerie became a physician assistant in this agricultural town. Families trusted her advice. They came back year after year. But then the University of Michigan took over. To keep her job, they made her complete a mandatory test. Along with an understanding of fire extinguishers and tornado safety, it required her to affirm certain claims about gender.
There was not an opportunity for me to say, no, gender is not fluid. We're created in the image of God. God designed us in His perfection.
All that landed her in a tense conference room with the diversity, equity, and inclusion team.
And the meeting went almost immediately hostile. I was called evil. I was called a liar. And it still hurts, right? It's one of those things where, right, time is a healer and I should be able to just... Right, that was a career I had been in for 17 years. Right, I wanted to work there my entire career, right?
And so that's Valerie Klosterman, Christian lady, hardworking, loves her patients, and decided that she would just, you know what, to avoid the whole pronoun thing, she would do what she's always done, which is refer to her patients by their name. So whatever name they put on that chart, that was her personal way of just serving her patients and making sure that as far as their medical, you know, their medical situation is taken care of. That's how she dealt with it. What happened next to Valerie after 17 years of hard work was just, I think by all accounts, well, she felt it was just unfair. Just suddenly, she was fired from her job and had to leave immediately. Felt like she was being treated like a criminal or something. And so I imagine that Valerie did what a lot of us do as Christians. She prayed and put this whole situation in God's hands. And God, I suppose, led her to some excellent attorneys there at First Liberty Institute. And that brings us to one of her attorneys, Doug Peterson, as she makes her case in court.
Doug Peterson.
We thought originally that maybe you're a Philly great Eagles coach as well as an attorney for Valerie. Good morning.
Yeah, I took credit for that Super Bowl win.
in all seriousness, you know, our hearts go out to Valerie. I think a lot of people can relate to this. And I even think of, you know, Riley Gaines locally, Paula Scanlon locally is, you know, talking to them. But, you know, different individuals who maybe in a locker room were just told by their coaches, shut up and take it. And this is yet another woman, hardworking woman in her environment. Mm-hmm. What I perceive here is she was just told, shut up and take it. And when she didn't, she was fired.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, these stories, I admire people like Valerie so much because they have the courage. They, you could easily just get along and go along, get along and not stand up. And Valerie's not that type of person. And her faith is very important to her family. And so she was willing to step up knowing that God's sovereign. But that doesn't make it easy. And it wasn't just her, you know, it impacts your family. Frankly, it had a big impact on her patients and her co-employees because she was really loved by her patients and the people she worked with. So, you know, it's so frustrating to see someone like the University of Michigan, who should know much better than to behave like this, just to come in and sweepingly say, you're out for such a foolish policy and disregarding all the, you know, 17 years of work and relationship she had developed.
And so with this, the lawsuit is filed and it's essentially civil rights. It's a constitutional case, First and 14th Amendments. Can you take us through, you know, as far as the lawsuit and how this is going so far?
Yeah. Yeah. We filed the lawsuit back in October of 22. and it contains both employment discrimination Title VII protections, which, you know, include race, religion, gender. Those issues are covered. And then because the University of Michigan is a public employer, then you have the provisions of the Constitution under the First Amendment, 14th Amendment. So anyway, there are a variety of claims in the lawsuit. The university initially responded by seeking a motion to dismiss, saying that there's no merit to any of this. And the federal district court judge in Michigan denied their motion to dismiss. But that took about a year in process. And so what happened is after that, after the court said, no, we're not going to dismiss the claim, then we started the discovery process. And it's at that time that the University of Michigan said, hey, by the way, she signed an agreement when she was working for us that she would submit all her claims to arbitration. Yeah. And we said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. You filed a motion to dismiss. We've been engaged with this court for 14 months. And now you're trying to say that this court has no jurisdiction mm-hmm. and it needs to go to arbitration. Actually, the federal district court judge agreed and said, okay, this should go to arbitration. We appealed that to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Oral argument was heard on it 2 weeks ago to the Sixth Circuit. We're very optimistic that what the Sixth Circuit is going to say is that the University of Michigan waived its claim for arbitration by engaging in, you know, 12 months of litigation in the federal court. So we're hopeful that it'll go back to the district court in Michigan, and then we'll start going through what's known as discovery.
And so that's just to proceed. And this is, so how many, I'm looking at, is it 3 years?
Yeah, it'll be 3 years in October.
My gosh.
So over two and a half years. Yeah.
And so what's, and, I guess, you know, at the end of the day, I got to tell you, Doug, a lot of people would just say, oh, man, just go on with your life, you know, to have to be dragged through this. And so also, is there a change in the culture and the conversation that's going on? I think, I mean, I will say that as a conservative, conservative women have been put through it. Okay, so
they
just,
have.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Just there, right. Not even dealing with what Valerie has done. So, you know, what do you say to a client, let's say a conservative woman, who says, you know, geez, this is all these years, I don't know if I can go on. Is that a conversation or what's happening?
You know, it is a conversation. And one of the things we do at First Liberty is we basically bring, I would call them a teammate. And she works closely with the clients, you know, is very engaged with them, not so much as a lawyer, but more as an encourager and saying, let me help me explain process to you, help me encourage you spiritually to, you know, understand, keep fighting the fight. And so we have on our team someone working with Valerie, and they become very close throughout the relationship. But it is difficult. You know, the thing about this that impresses me so much is Valerie and her husband, Mike, and their children. I think they are her biggest encourager, members of her church, and they all recognize that, you know, Valerie is stepping into a very difficult fight. And she needs that. It's really the body of Christ, right?
Mm-hmm.
Standing together to encourage. And so I think that's what gets them through. They're not abandoned on their own. Now she's been able to find subsequent employment, but the pain is still very fresh. It doesn't take too long to pull back that stab just a little bit and feel the pain. So anyway, I just admire all the women who have stepped forward and said, I'm not going to stand for this.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing about it is it's just from an intellectual standpoint, it's medical foolishness what's going on here to suggest that because someone perceives themselves because of a dysphoria, that they perceive themselves to be a different gender. And it's not just the pronouns. It's promoting transition surgeries and other things of that nature. And Valerie should. Mm-hmm. There's no medical evidence to support that that's effective. And what do you want me now if he's a male? I've treated him as a male for the last 3 years. Now he perceives himself as female. You want me to be recommending a pap smear and a breast exam? I mean, how does that work in the medical field? It's silliness. And I think, you know, you mentioned that there's a little bit of a change going on.
Yes.
And I do think there is. I, you know, certainly over in Europe, they've been more realistic in recognizing that these transition surgeries are not producing positive outcomes. And
they've changed.
It's taken us.
So as an attorney, I want to ask you on the flip side of things then. So say she did indeed listen to the suggestions of University of Michigan, and she gave gender-affirming care to an individual who later regretted it. Doesn't that open herself up for lawsuits for going through with this, you know, now regrettable decision that this person has? Or how's that work?
Exactly. That I think, is going to be the new lawsuit into the future, is because on what medical basis did you have, and frankly, in the office I work in Lincoln, Nebraska, we've got a claim filed against the University of Nebraska on this very issue of a 15-year-old just turned 16 and starts going into the transition, has the top surgery, the hormone changes, her voice, all of that. She's now in her 20s and realizes no adult really stepped up and protected her. Who were these doctors who were pushing the surgery so quickly? Mm-hmm. You know, the old method of treatment was with gender dysphoria through the what's known as the DSM-5. It was basically you had to do at least a year to 2 years of intensive training with adolescents, and typically 85 to 90% of them, after going through that type of intense year to 2 year therapy, would re-identify with their biological sex. This surgery came in, they make a lot of money off it, and boom, 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 all those standards just kind of went up in the air.
So was Valerie, though, was this where she was also treating teenagers or underage children as well as adults?
She would, as part of her patient care, and okay. The question was her willingness to refer them on, and she said, you know, I can't do that. I can't, in good faith, recommend that they start considering that.
There's so much to unravel here, but in this case, Doug, it's really about, you know, your religious, your faith-based rights. And so in the medical field, you know, and I think about locally our hospitals, a lot of people, you know, have gone through that DEI type of training, right? And they've done their best to try to wrap their brains around everything to be compliant. But at the same time, there is a conflict there. And so what is this case? Do you see this case as one of those cases that could potentially go all the way to the Supreme Court, or at the very least, because you're dealing with issues that are about the Constitution, where this would set or help set a national precedent?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, First Liberty was a part of a case named Groff, and he was a Postal Service carrier in Pennsylvania, I believe. Anyway, that case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, this was under Title VII protection, and the question was, he was asking for an accommodation not to work on Sundays.
Yes.
And the reasonable accommodation request was denied. At one point, it was granted, and then they denied it. And the argument was, what type of burden is the employer under? And the Supreme Court came back and said that one of its earlier decisions had been improperly interpreted by the lower courts, and that what an employer has to do is, when an employee comes forward and says, I have a sincerely held religious belief in what you're asking me to do, and I'd ask that you would accommodate that belief and allow me to do, you know, X, Y, Z. The employer now is under a burden to do that unless they can show that to do it would cause a substantial undue hardship. And substantial is a significant word there, undue hardship. They have to show that it would be really difficult for the employer to accommodate that request. So that is a good, and that's applicable in Valerie's case. They would have to show that for her to say, hey, I would prefer just to use their name instead of using pronouns, use their name in the medical records, and not be required to recommend transition surgery. That's a reasonable accommodation that would not have caused an undue hardship to the University of Michigan.
Yeah, and if I can interject this, Doug, I just looked that up, and it's a story dated, you know, and this is just within the past month, that the U.S. District Court right here at the Eastern District of Pennsylvania had rejected, his name is Gerald Groff, the motion for summary judgment. So that trial apparently now moves forward after these multiple years.
Yeah, and there is, when you file something at the motion for summary judgment level, basically you're asking the court to acknowledge or agree that there's no disputed facts. And if there's no disputed facts, then at the summary judgment level, the court could rule on the undisputed facts and the law. In that case, oftentimes the court will say, no, I think there are some questions that have to be presented to a jury. So that's not that, it's not as if the district court rejected the Groff opinion from the Supreme Court. They just said, no, there's some factual questions here that should go to a jury and not be decided at summary judgment.
So basically, they're not going to cut to the chase, but it still is moving forward to trial. And he was, and we have reported on this over the years because he's evangelical Christian, and it's they don't have the option of, like, a lot of, you know, in the Catholic Church, for example, you can go Saturday, you can go Saturday evening, or there are multiple different services all day Sunday. In many evangelical churches, it is Sunday, and oftentimes it's 3 to 4 hours. And so that's a big piece of that. So that's an interesting case. I'm glad you brought that, you know, with religious rights. For her, where does this, you know, where does this go now? Where do you think this is leading as far as with Valerie?
Well, our hope is you always have to be guarded when you you go to an appeals court and you hear the questions. Sometimes you can get very excited and say, hey, those really sound favorable. I think they're seeing it our way. I would say our overall impression 2 weeks ago when the case was argued to the Sixth Circuit was very positive. And so we think what the court, our hope is that the court will come back and say that the University of Michigan waived their arbitration clause provision by engaging in proceedings with the federal court. And then we'll start the discovery process. We'll start demanding documents. We'll start taking depositions. If the court doesn't rule in our favor, then we go to an arbitration process. And that's a little bit less formal. And it's also, it moves more quickly. But time's not the issue here for us. It's the thoroughness of the discovery that we're most concerned about.
And so, you know, for somebody like Valerie and her husband and their kids, how do they, I think most people would say, well, how in the world do I pay attorneys? How does it work with First Liberty? Because I believe that through a whole lot of support that you can support families like this in these faith-based rights cases.
Yeah, that's it exactly. First Liberty is a nonprofit organization, and it's supported by a lot of generous givers who understand that in this current day and age, there's legal fights for people like Valerie and Mike, who to pay a lawyer for this would be really difficult. To find a lawyer who would take on a contingency fee can be difficult. But through First Liberty, we also have, so I'm a private practicing attorney in Lincoln, Nebraska. But I do work for First Liberty. There's also large firms that will do pro bono work and make their lawyers available. So it really builds out a strong team of lawyers. In fact, that was who argued the case to the Sixth Circuit. So First Liberty really takes that burden off of them and provides this support network and provides some lawyers who've taken this type of issue, you know, all the way up to the Supreme Court. So it's pretty deep level of experience that you get access to.
Well, Doug Peterson, First Liberty Institute, we hope that we can keep in contact with you, and we'll certainly hold you up in prayer. And anybody certainly can go to First Liberty Institute, firstliberty.org, if you'd like to read more, learn more, or support First Liberty Institute. Doug Peterson, thanks a million for being here today.
You bet. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Doug.
Don Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.